her to go to the hospital all the time.
Good afternoon, colleagues, members of the public. I'm calling to order this June 3rd, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. This will be our last formal meeting of this session. What's on the agenda today is we have a couple of bills to work, and we'll do that at the end of the meeting. Before that, we're going to have an informational hearing on the issue of prevailing wage. This will, I know that it will be very informative, and I know it will be very useful. I also hope it'll be long enough that we get paperwork on these bills that we're waiting for. So with that, I'm going to open an informational meeting on prevailing wage. And I'm going to call up Susan Woolley, first of all, from Boley, to give us an overview.
Hello.
Hello, welcome.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks for having me here today. So I understand we have about 30 minutes to cover this information. Usually takes a lot longer than that, so it's a pretty brief overview. I just had a class this morning in Portland that took 3 hours, and it's just scratching the surface. So that kind of gives you an idea of it's pretty complex.
And let me say, this is a non-credit course we're doing today, so
you
can abbreviate.
Okay, no test afterwards or anything. Well, I have some slides that I believe you have access to. These are the topics that I was hoping we'd be able to cover, talking a little bit about the basics of the laws, coverage, what is it that triggers the coverage for the prevailing wage rate laws. I have the list of agency and contractor responsibilities, and that's more informational. I'll go over any that you have questions on, but I wasn't going to spend a lot of time on that. But I did understand that you had some questions about how the rates are set, which is through a survey process. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about that. There were some questions, I think, on worker classification. So I talk a little bit about how we do those. And then I wanted to just touch on bonds and the importance that bonds play in the investigations that we do with Boley. Okay.
Great. Thank you.
So to start with, these state prevailing wage rate laws that we're talking about, they were passed back in 1959, so they have been around for a while. They were based on the federal Davis-Bacon Act. So they're real similar to the federal laws. They're not identical, though. There are some differences between the two. And, of course, over the years, the laws have been changed. Usually not really big changes, but in 1994, there was a measure that went before the voters to actually repeal the prevailing wage rate laws. It didn't pass, but then in the following legislative session in 1995, there were some pretty big changes made to the prevailing wage law. 2005, again, saw some big changes. I did hear that you were interested in the history of these laws, so you should all have one of these little blue Peterborough handbooks. In the beginning of the book, there is actually a history of the laws going back to 1957, and it details the changes that have happened since then. When a project is subject to these laws, the main things that the contractors are going to focus on is, what do I have to pay to my workers? And you should also have one of our prevailing wage rate books. So these are the rates that they'll pay. And you'll see the rates are always broken out into a base rate plus a fringe rate. And it's a combination of those two together that then would be paid to the worker. Now, the entire thing doesn't necessarily have to be paid in wages. Some employers pay for benefits for their workers. They contribute to retirement plans. They might pay for medical care. Those types of benefits, as long as they meet certain criteria, they actually get to count that as part of the prevailing wage rate. So you see this base plus fringe out of the book. Sometimes that's just paid directly to the worker. Sometimes it's partially paid to the worker as wages. Sometimes it's benefits. Now, I included a slide that includes the purpose of the prevailing wage rate laws. And you'll see at the bottom of a lot of slides, there's the ORS reference or the OAR, the Oregon Administrative Rule reference. Those statutes and rules are in the back of the little blue book if you wanted to check those out. So the idea behind the laws is to even the playing field and hopefully help protect our local contractors. So if everybody has to bid on equal footing for the same kind of work that they're doing, the hope is that the local contractors will be more competitive than a contractor who's coming from the other side of the country. Our local contractors will probably have local employees. They'll probably have access to local materials and supplies. And ideally, then they would end up being the most competitive bidder on these public projects. And if they do have local employees, it helps that public money stay there in the community. And you'll see the second bullet on this slide. It says maintain community established compensation standards, which is a fancy way to say we would like the workers to get paid the going rate in the community. And again, that's where these rate books come in. So ideally, we've got local contractors with local workers getting paid the local rate. The contractors are also encouraged to provide training to workers, which would be through apprenticeship programs. And they're also encouraged to provide benefits for the workers. So rather than pay that whole wage directly to the worker, use some of that to pay for medical care or to contribute to retirement plans for those workers. Any questions so far? Okay. Coverage is not always an easy question. We have what we call a two-step test. So first, we're going to look to see if the project meets the definition of the term public works. And if it does, we go on to the second step, is to see if any of the exemptions from the law might apply to that project. So this term public works, this is something that does get changed with each legislative session. Not always, but sometimes there are little tweaks here and there. It's currently a five-part definition, parts A, B, C, D, and E. So part A, this is the most common type of project that we would see. It's a project that includes construction, reconstruction, major renovation, or painting, and it's carried on or contracted for by a public agency to serve the public interest. This could be something like a new school gets built, a new bridge gets built, a new road is constructed. It doesn't have to be big, fancy, though. Sometimes smaller projects are subject to these laws, too. It could be something like potholes being fixed in the road, or the library replaces the carpeting in the building, or even systems furniture going into a public building. That would also be reconstruction. Any questions on the type of work that we're talking about with those projects?
Yeah, the issue of serve the public interest. I think we had a bill this time that had some relevancy to that. I can't remember exactly why that was at issue.
Well, to serve the public interest is not a term that's defined in statute, but it's come up so many times, we actually have had to go to Department of Justice for help with it. So the definition that we use is it's something that's to the well-being of the community. And I think that's usually a given. If it's being carried on or contracted for by the public agency, it is because it serves the well-being of the community.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe have there been disputes when you're talking about a mixed-use kind of building?
Oh. Right. We haven't had that come up to whether or not it serves the public interest. We haven't had that be an issue with any of our coverage determinations that we've done. We focus more on the carried on or contracted for by, and if that does happen, it usually then follows that it's because it does serve the public interest. Now, the mixed use, that probably comes up with parts B or C. Okay, so that's a little bit different definition. Part B says it's, again, construction, reconstruction, major renovation, or painting. See those same terms over and over again. This is on privately owned property. It does need to use some private money, and it also uses at least $750,000 or more in public funds. We see this there are some agencies out there that give out grants and loans, sometimes to private nonprofits, sometimes to private developers. So this trigger would be for private property that uses private funds and $750,000 in public funds. So for this, there's not that requirement to serve the public interest. Part C is a little different. This is for privately owned construction, where the public agency will occupy or use at least a quarter of the square footage of that finished project. So we don't see this one too often, but we do see projects that fall under B quite a bit. Any questions on those? Part D is one of the newer bits of the definition of public works. It was done by the 2010 legislature. And it says that the installation or construction of a device that uses solar power, if that's done on public property, that will be subject to the prevailing wage laws. It doesn't matter what the project cost is. It doesn't even matter if the project uses only private funds. This is just by virtue of being done on public property, that would be the trigger for the laws for that type of a project. And the last one, this is the newest one. This was done by the 2013 legislature. So this is the construction, reconstruction, major renovation, or painting, again, those same terms. It's on Oregon University System property, or property that an institution within Oregon University System owns. That project could be done and not use any public funds, and it would still be subject to the prevailing wage laws.
That's one we changed this year. To clarify the university,
it
doesn't have to go through the OUS system since the OUS system no longer exists.
Right. So the big three withdrew, and I heard the others might withdraw too. Right. Okay. Well, there is one last piece of the definition of public works that actually, it basically allows for an exemption. It says that public works does not include the reconstruction or renovation of privately owned property that's leased by a public agency. And that does have a specific definition. It's defined as improvements of all types within the framework or footprint of an existing building. So if a public agency were to say, we need to expand, but we don't have the square footage, so we're going to go across the street to a private building, they could actually do work within the footprint of that existing building, and this allowance says that would not be subject to prevailing wage. That's the end of the first step. The second step then is to look for exemptions from the law. This first one is a $50,000 project cost. Generally, projects have to exceed that $50,000 threshold, except there is an exception now for the exemption. Those solar projects that are on public property, those do not have to meet the $50,000 threshold. They're covered even if they're less than that. Every other project, though, would have to exceed that amount. And the project cost, this is the cost of all the contracts associated with that project. So you could certainly have a single project made up of five different $20,000 contracts, and in total it's a $100,000 project. So each contract would still be subject to the prevailing wage laws. There's an exemption that if the project doesn't use any public funds, either directly or indirectly, the laws would not apply. There are two exceptions now to this exemption. So the solar projects on public property don't have to use public funds, and the construction, reconstruction, major renovation, or painting on Oregon University System property don't have to use public funds. The last exemption is for privately owned residential construction that predominantly provides affordable housing. These projects might use millions of dollars in public funds, but this exemption says that doesn't matter. They still won't be subject to the state prevailing wage rate laws. Any questions on those? Okay. Sometimes it's really easy to tell when you've got a covered project, but not always. And we do have a process in place if people have questions. We call it our coverage determination process, where the requester will give us all the information about that project. We'll then make the determination whether or not the law is applied to it. The nice thing about this formalized process is we post our determinations online so anybody can review them. And if the person is adversely affected or aggrieved by our determination, they can actually request a hearing. And then we'll go before an administrative law judge. Once a project is covered, that's when all the responsibilities kick in. So you'll see there's a nice long list of agency responsibilities. I wasn't planning on going into detail with these unless you're curious. Do you want to know about any of them? Okay.
Vice Chair, do you have any?
Just looking at the list here. Agency now, are you just boil your agency responsibilities? Is that what you're referring to?
So this is when, say, Oregon Department of Transportation does a public works project. This is the list of all the things they need to make sure they do to stay in compliance with the prevailing wage laws for that project.
Is there any limit as to time limits? Sometimes they close out jobs and years later get back to an employer and say, hey, you didn't do this right.
Oh, well, there's a statute of limitations for wages owed that goes back 6 years. So I suppose that would be the outside limit. It's kind of kind of a long time. I don't know if they would ever do that.
Years is a long time.
Right,
any,
right.
Any combination thereof, yeah. Okay, just curious.
Okay. This is the list of contractor responsibilities. It's a little bit longer than the agency one. And these same responsibilities are in the little blue book for more details on those. Now, construction industry survey, you'll see that's the last one on the list, and I was planning to talk a little bit more about that. But before we do that, do you have any questions about any of those responsibilities?
I do have a question about apprentices. Will you be going into those at all?
No, but I can.
So paying apprentices correctly, how are apprentices paid under?
So good question. So apprentices, they will be in a training program, and that training program is going to stipulate what their pay is supposed to be. But once they start work on a prevailing wage project, the employer has to take that into consideration too. So if this is higher, they'll need to bump that apprentice up to the prevailing wage rate. And, you know, as I mentioned, the rate is made up of a base rate plus a fringe. The base portion, the apprentice will get a percentage of that base portion depending on where they are in their program. 60% apprentice would get 60% of the base. The fringe is a little different. If the rate for the apprentice comes from what we call the region pages in the front of the book, the apprentice gets 100% of the fringe, no reduction on that fringe part. If they look up their rate and it says see appendix, and the rate comes from the back of the book, then there's a possibility that the apprentice might get paid less than the full fringe. It's based on the prevailing practice for that trade in that area. And so the contractors will need to go to Bowie's website and look to see if there's a reduction in the fringe for that area and that classification.
And is that determined through Bowie rulemaking? Do the trades have a chance to, you know, challenge that or, you know, affect a change?
Do you mean for how the apprentices are paid?
Yeah, whether, yes, and maybe this leads to larger questions about how the prevailing wage is set and perhaps.
I think part of it leads into that where when the rate comes from the front of the book, that's when we have a statewide average rate, and the union rate has not prevailed on the survey. So the union practice doesn't prevail. So when we go to the back of the book to look up the rates in the appendix section, that's where the union rate has prevailed for that particular trade in that area, and that's where the union trade would prevail. So if that particular union reduces the apprentice's fringe amount, that's where it would be allowed on a prevailing wage project as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
And who decides that, and is that through collaborative discussion?
That's where the survey comes in, which was what we're going to talk about next, how that survey ends up helping to set these rates for the book.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure.
That was my question.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's go to that one then. So here's the construction industry survey. This is the survey that's done once a year, and it helps set the rates for these rate books. It's done by Employment Department. They will do it for us. They mail out the surveys in about July of each year, and they're due back in about September of each year. And they're surveying all the contractors who have done non-residential work within the state of Oregon. Now, the surveys have changed a little bit over the years, too. They're trying to make it easier for the contractors but still get enough useful information to make the information that they get helpful for the commissioner when he sets the rates. So they asked for 4 weeks of work, one per quarter. It's in February, May, August, and November, and it's always the week that includes the 12th of the month. So the contractors can kind of prepare for it ahead of time. They know which weeks they're going to get asked about. If they didn't work those weeks, they don't have anything to report then on the survey. The responses that come in, they are not releasable. They're not public record, and that is under statute. But the contractors are required to respond. It's not an optional survey. So if they get it, they do have to give that information back. Once the Employment Department gathers all that information, that's what they then give to the commissioner to help him set the rates for this book. And this is the rate book. This is called Sage Green, if you can believe that. On page 5 in the rate book, you'll see a map of Oregon, and it's broken out into 14 different regions. So the responses from the surveys will also be broken out into these 14 different regions. When we talked about the reasons behind the laws, one was so that the workers get paid the going rate in the community. These are the communities that we're talking about. So when the responses are broken out by region, they will be further broken out by occupation. So when you look at the region pages, you'll see all these occupations listed. Sometimes there's a rate, and sometimes it says see appendix, and that is based on the survey responses. So if more than 50% of the hours reported for a particular region and for a particular occupation are union hours, that's when the union rate prevails, and that's when you see it will say see appendix. If less than 50% of the hours reported are union hours, it doesn't prevail, and you end up with a statewide average for that particular occupation. That's where you see the rate here in the region page. So that's why when you do have an apprentice, if it's a region rate for that apprentice, the union rate did not prevail. So the union practice of paying less than the fringe doesn't prevail. So they have to be paid 100% of the fringe amount. Any questions about that?
Well, I have a question about the survey being sent out to any contractor that has done non-residential work, correct?
Correct.
And so how is that determined? Because there can be residential contractors who have done non-residential. So do they also get the survey?
That's a good question. I don't do a lot with the survey. So my information on it is real basic. I know that Employment Department has what they call a contractor universe. And so they will look at contractors who are registered with Construction Contractors Board, and then they will also look at the codes that the business has to see if it's a construction-related business. And they would err on the side of caution and send it out to everybody and let that contractor respond back and say, no, we only did residential work. So they're going to try to get as much information as they can and then rely on the contractors to respond appropriately.
Okay. I have another question. I can't remember what it is right now.
Oh, keep going. We can always come back to it. Okay. Any other questions on that particular information? All right. I heard that you were also wondering about worker classification. So we have another book for you. This is the Yellow Definitions of Covered Occupations. This is a really good tool for the contractors to correctly classify their workers. It will list all of the classifications that you would find in the rate book, and it lists the typical duties that fall under those classifications. So maybe they're not sure if they have a laborer or carpenter. This would tell them the difference between the two. Or they might know that they have a power equipment operator, but there's a group 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, and they might not know which group that person should fall under. This book would help with this. Now, all these reference materials are available online, so if you wanted to, you could certainly get them on from Bowley's website if you didn't have the hard copies. Did you have other more specific questions about classification?
How do they come up with the classification? I mean, they're broken down in tiny, minute little pieces that don't necessarily even fit all the time.
In some cases, it does get pretty specific. It's based on a lot of research and looking at not only what U.S. Department of Labor does, but what other states that have prevailing wage rate law does. And it's also on the prevailing practice for what happens within the state of Oregon. So that's how we end up with the definitions. Now, we have a new process. I don't know if this is something that you're interested in knowing about, but inside front cover, there's a new process if people would like to suggest changes to the definitions. And so that's something that we would go through and review those changes. We'd look to see, as long as there are no other conflicts with other classifications, we would also get comments from interested parties. Anybody around the state could comment on what they think about the suggested changes. And then the commissioner will make the final decision on whether the change would be made or not.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that you do some research looking at U.S. Department of Labor and other states with prevailing wage rate laws. Are there states that don't have prevailing wage rate laws?
Oh, there actually are.
Really? Wow, okay.
Several years. Idaho doesn't have prevailing wage laws. There were 32 states that had the prevailing wage rate laws, but I think that's changed since I've looked that up. So there are some out there that don't. Yeah. Who knew? Now, the Davis-Bacon Act would still apply in those states, though, the federal laws.
Okay, maybe that's where I'm conflating the two.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, and actually, that does lead to a question of mine. So are there major differences between big bacon and little bacon?
Good question. A few. It's pretty similar. But overtime is one of the big differences, where the federal laws require overtime after 40 hours in the week. State law requires overtime on a daily basis, after 8 in a day, for all hours worked on Saturdays and Sundays, and 6 holidays. There's a difference in a pay schedule. State law says you can pay monthly. The Davis-Bacon Act requires weekly pay. There are slight differences in the certified payroll forms that contractors have to use. Nothing too major, but just some slight paperwork issues.
But in general, even if a state doesn't have its own version of the Bacon-Davis Act, there'll be something like this process.
Right. So it would need to use federal money that requires compliance with that Davis-Bacon Act. Say in Idaho, maybe if they were to build a new road and it used federal transportation dollars, that project would probably be subject to the Davis-Bacon Act. Yeah. Sure. Well, that takes us to the bond slides that I wanted to touch on, just to let you know how important the bonds are to our investigations. We do have two types of bonds that we have access to help make sure the workers are fully paid. One is a payment bond, and one is a public works bond. Now, some of the odd things about the bonding is that some of the authority and requirements actually come from outside the prevailing wage laws. The prevailing wage laws are 279C800 to 870. And you'll see on this slide, the authority to file a bond actually comes from 279C600. So it's not from the prevailing wage rate laws itself. The payment bond that I mentioned, that also comes from outside the prevailing wage laws. That's in 279C380. So when 279-380 applies to a public improvement contract, the general contractor on that contract will typically need to file a payment bond for any contract that's $100,000 or more than $100,000. The public works bond, that is solely within the prevailing wage rate law requirements, that's required of any employer who must pay prevailing wage. And it's a $30,000 bond. It's not project specific like the payment bond is. So once a contractor has that public works bond, they can work on as many projects as they want to, and they'll all be covered by the one bond. Now, when these come into play, after we do an investigation, if wages are owed, we're always going to try and collect from the employer. That's the first step. If that's not possible for some reason, then we would file a claim against the employer's public works bond. There are some exemptions from the public works bond, though. So some employers don't have it. Some maybe just aren't in compliance and don't have it. And if that were to happen, or if there were more than $30,000 in wages owed, that's where we would go to the payment bond, the prime contractor's payment bond, to collect those wages. So without those, it does become much more difficult to collect the wages that are owed to the workers. Any questions on those? Okay. There's some links to all the documentation that we gave you today, the law books, the rate books, the definition books, and then just the BOLI website as well is there. And in case you remember the question down the road, contact numbers, always feel free to call us anytime. And I believe you also have my cards up there. Keep my cards handy if you have questions down the road. Anything else you'd like to ask?
Thank you very much, Susan.
Okay, you're welcome.
Other questions?
Just a comment.
Yes, please.
Putting on my employer hat for a second. Yeah. Bully is always very helpful in asking answering the questions, not asking them, but answering questions that.
Thank you.
I know my office has.
Well, you know, we really try to. We want to help the contractors get it right. I hear a lot of times contractors say, "I don't want to call Bully because then I'll be on their radar," but we really want to be there for them if we can. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Susan. So let's hear from John Rakowitz and Larry Gesher, please. And you're going to stick around, Susan?
Yes.
Yeah. If any questions come up that are technical in nature, or if they start getting too brutal, you know, we'll call you in.
I'll kick off. Chair Dimbro, members of the committee, John Rakowitz with AGC for the record, and I'm really here today as a resource, mostly on the policy side, if broader policy issues surface questions, since I've been involved in pretty much every bill related to prevailing wage for many, many cycles. I have with me today Larry Gesher. He'll introduce himself. He is this year's president of the board of AGC, Oregon Columbia chapter. And what I've asked him to do is make it real. And so he's done a handout that you should have. He's going to be going through this, that list of responsibilities contractors has. This is the doing end of what's up there. And it gets pretty complex pretty quick. But I've asked him to try to walk through and do you a quick and at least a brief sort of drive-by, just take you through what he does. And he has a unique background as a contractor as well that he'll speak to. Then I'll hand it over to Larry.
Thanks, John. I know Susan made it all sound nice and peachy and wrote. Oh, sorry. I'm Larry Gesher. My company's HP Civil. And so I'll walk you guys through a little bit of the background as far as the process we go through when we get a job. I'll give you a background. I came from a large contractor. I was on the project manager of Selwood Bridge for 3 years before going out on my own and starting a business. So now I have an emerging small business that we've been in a year, business just over a year. And so the hats have changed a lot for me, whereas on a project like Selwood, I had four staff underneath me working on prevailing wage type issues from certified payrolls through apprenticeship, and then also that gets into the whole workforce makeup and tracking process. So the handout that each of you have is this right here. This is pulled out of the project we're working on, and the first page right here is this is an ODOT project, and so right away it lists you to the wage rates. ODOT has a website they set up, and they put the wage rates on by the bid opening date. And so you can always go back, people, subs, and everybody can access the rates easy that way. You can go to Bully and get them. But this way here, if you click on the project, you always know if the date of bid, you always know you have the right rates as a starting point. And so this, a lot of our state highway type projects are also we have to go through and figure out the higher of the two between the federal and the state wages. So the book that we have here does cover both sets, and so we'll kind of walk through it so you can kind of see the process. And so anybody bidding on a public works contract, you have to go through this process and figure out what your wages are, because each job is unique in the fact of their zone pays, and it all comes down to reference cities and how far the job is from a given reference city. And the case of carpenters, you can get into the reference from for the distance from their house to the project. And so you kind of got to weigh it out on each job. And so if you flip back through and on page 3, which is kind of the first piece of the Davis-Bacon, I'm just going to walk you through one of them here. Carpenters right there on page 3. So if you see up there, zone 1, the base carpenter is $32.61 an hour. The fringe is $14.44 an hour. Then you come down, another one there is pile drivers, $33.61 an hour, $14.44 an hour. And then you got to get into the zone piece of it. And so the zone piece of it, as you read down there, it all comes down to the distance from the given reference city, or in some cases, the individual's home and where they live. But some trades are by road miles, and some are by air miles. And so you have to understand the difference between which trades are by road and which ones are by air, and then which employees you're going to have on the job and to get the zone pay. In this case, this project I'm referring to is up on Highway 58, near the tunnel on Highway 58. And so the distance is more than 60 miles from the given reference city down below, which is Eugene. And so, which would mean that zone 5 would pay would apply, so it's an extra $2 added to the fringe or added to the base there. Then if you flip back, it's the beginning of the Bully book. So page 13 on the front. And this is where Susan's talking about the regions. And so in the given case, the project I'm referring to, you'll see The first page is there. It'll say Region 1, Clatsop, Columbia, Tillamook County. In our given case, we're in Lane County. So you flip back, and it's on page 23 of 52 at the bottom right. And so the one thing that we get a little unique in the state is that we have a category for bridge and highway carpenter where the federal side doesn't break it out that way. So in a given case of a bridge, it's 3354 and 1442. And a regular carpenter group 1 and 2 is 2911 and 1164. And this is where these rates actually apply in this case. This is where the union rate did not prevail. And so these would be the rates that we pay. The pile driver down below, the 3381 and the 1459. But I'll take you back and show you, because a lot of the cases, if you look there on this page, you see a lot of appendix. And so a lot of the time we're digging back further. So if you continue to flip through, get back to page 35 is the beginning. 35 of 52. Bottom left shows carpenters. And there's where you got to understand your different groups of carpenters. Where group 5 and group 6 are the bridge and the pile driver categories, which are in the definition book to get there. I'll show you some nuances of some of that in a minute. But this is where it gets into, you shows you if you refer back to the appendix here, you go through and you find your carpenters. And if you look at the upper right, it says zones for groups 5 and 6 carpenters are identified by distance between the project site and either the workers' residence or the city hall. And then once again, those city hall references right there are only references on the upper, which I call the right, for group 5 and 6. They're unique in that they only have 6 reference cities. And so you end up in a pretty high group or pretty high zone pretty quickly with those two categories. And I guess the one thing that kind of has helped us a lot on the highway side is working with ODOT. We've worked through a process now. If you flip to the very last sheet of this packet, this is what, as contractors, we would go through and do on every job we bid or every given to understand what we're putting in our estimates. ODOT now does this on every project they have, and they post this on their website with the plans and the specifications. And so everybody bidding on this project now has access to what ODOT has determined to be the correct wages for the project. And that will come down and include the zone pay. In some cases, depending on the carpenters, that could change if you actually referring back to the appendixes I talked about. And then there's a footnote there about the iron workers too. So their zone will max out at 75 per day. And so on the source on the right side, it shows you which prevailed, Boley or Davis-Bacon. And then if it's blank, they're the same between the two. They match. A lot of times the Boleys will prevail. It's a higher wage on the majority of the time on a lot of our stuff anyway. And so this has been a huge help. I know on the ODOT work, and I know bidding other public work stuff, we still have to go through and do this, and I think it's something that the agency could easily get into and post wages for projects when people are bidding on it. It would take a lot of problems out that we see with certified payrolls, with especially the smaller firms not getting the wages right. And if they don't have them right when they're turning into the general, and we see they're wrong, that means they're wrong in their estimate too. And usually they're not wrong in their favor. It's usually higher. And so this has taken a lot of issues out for smaller contractors. I mean, when you're a small contractor, you have, you know, a day job, you do build the job, and at night you come in and bid jobs. And so this takes a big step out of the process to have to go through and identify the wages for the job when you we can pull this. ODOT has a huge disclaimer attached to this. They take no liability associated with these numbers if they're wrong. But it doesn't take long for us to look at them and verify. It's a lot easier to run through and verify that they're correct than it is to go through and put them together. And so I guess my thing would be, I think it'd be a great thing for Boley to do on public works as far as the industry is provide wages for the public works jobs.
Larry, let me interrupt you there, or John. Has anybody communicated that to the commissioner, that you'd like to see this project taken on, or is there a some kind of advisory group that
we have an ODOT advisory group? There's no BOLI advice. Well, there's a PWAC.
There, John Rakowitz. There is a prevailing wage advisory group appointed by the commissioner. They do sometimes take up these issues. This has been in the works for a long time. I think for as long as I've been involved, this has been an issue that the contractors have been raising with ODOT, because until recently there was a fair amount of work, and what was happening was ODOT was providing some level of, those numbers look right, but then when it went to BOLI, it wouldn't look right. So they've been working at this for a long time. The one thing I will point out is, when you say something like that, we would love to see that, but if you go back to what Susan was talking about, because we have the state Davis-Bacon Act, this applies to all public work in the state of Oregon. So you're talking about every public agency that does any kind of public work. So that's a big ticket item. But it's something a lot of times we'll work with a particular public owner, in this case ODOT, and go, how do you improve this process? Because what Larry's going to get to in a second is walk you through the list of ineligible contractors. Because ultimately what we're talking about here is fines. They can be, as Senator Thatcher mentioned, they can go back quite a number of years. That job, you know, has been over. They're waiting for the final payment, closing of that job, and you suddenly find out somebody makes a claim. Well, now how do you deal with that? So this is a really complicated process, but I think that is a process improvement that has only, I think this has only been in effect like 4 or 5 months, Larry?
Yeah, a little longer, yeah.
This
yeah.
ODOT one?
Yeah, yeah, this is something that's been worked on for years, and so now you have a model, people can start thinking about it, to answer your question.
Well, something to think about. Do you know, either of you know if any other states have something like that?
I don't.
Yeah, I think they do. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm pretty sure Washington actually does.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
So, yeah, I mean, and part of that had to do with the fact of ODOT's one of probably the few agencies that really does a good, thorough job of actually looking at the certified payrolls and checking them. So at the end of the day, for them to check them, they had to go through and develop the rates themselves for every job. And so it was kind of a, yeah, we'd like to say as AGC, we worked with ODOT and they did this. But at the end of the day, they were doing it for themselves too, because they had to do it in every job. And they just happened to get a really smart guy on it that was pretty technologically savvy, and he figured out a really quick and easy way to do it, to where it'll check the airline miles, it'll check the road distances, and so it's a matter of just putting in coordinates, and it knows all the state highways in the system, and it can identify it. On page, if you flip back to page 41 of 52. That is the beginning of the list of ineligible contractors that can bid on public works in the state of Oregon. That list used to be about 4 or 5 contractors long about 8-10 years ago. It's now 69. And I think if you look at a lot of these firms, there's a lot of MWESB firms. Within the state of Oregon, we're really pushing hard on MWESB contractors to get involved in jobs. People get involved in, there's a lot of complexity to prevailing wage, and you know there's bad actors out there too that are trying to play the games with things, but there's also people that are making mistakes, and it's just a lack of knowledge and understanding. But you can see the list of firms there that can't bid on public works jobs, and the durations there that they can't bid on them. So that part's especially as a general contractor, where we're always trying to look for small MWSB firms to put into our goals on jobs, and then to see a lot of them get wiped out and ineligible. And so this is something we have to watch as well, to make sure that these people aren't turning in bids to us that we're relying on when they're not eligible to bid. Right. And so,
Vice Chair, what's the name of your company?
Yeah, it's on page 4 right at the bottom.
It's got the whiteout through it. And then just to show you another little nuance of things that we run into, on the definitions book, which is the yellow book, this is really the Bible for us as open shop contractors, is to make sure we get people in the right classification. But if you flip to page 29, So I've got a 100-ton lattice crane. So I come in here and I look for my operator, what I'm paying this operator for running a 100-ton lattice boom crane. And if you go to the top of the page, the second bullet down says crane, lattice boom, 50 tons through 89 tons with 150 foot of boom or less. Okay, that's not me. It's too small. You come down to the group four, come down the bottom, it says crane, lattice boom, under 50 ton. That's not me because I'm 100 ton. If you go back over to group two, crane, lattice boom, they got crane, lattice boom, 90 ton through 199 ton. Okay, that's me. But now it's with 150 foot of boom to 200 foot of boom. Okay, I'm running 80 foot of boom. Where do I go? It's not in here. And so those are the type of things you run into. And so you'd call Bowley, and the response you'll get is to pay the higher of the two if you have a conflict. And so we always err and pay the high. And so in this case, we'd bump up a size, even though if you look at the book, it's not there. And so I could go through here and show you piles and piles of those types of things that gets people in trouble that ultimately lands them on this little list in here, because you think you know what you're doing, and then you start getting into it, and you find stuff like that, and it's like, where do you go? And so you'll call, but that you'll get the answer to pay the higher of the two every time you call. And so that's the frustrating part that people run into, that if you haven't been around a long time, you may not know necessarily, okay, error and always pay high. As contractors, we tend to be pretty frugal. But so your inclination is to always pay employees more money, but in the case of this, you have to. Otherwise, you will get in trouble.
Larry, in your experience, before a company gets put on the wall of shame, is there notice to them? I mean, does does somebody reach out to them and counsel them?
Yeah.
This is John. I just want to respond to a couple of two or three things. Susan, in 2010, 2011, I don't remember when, Susan, when the private construction market collapsed, I started getting calls from contractors who had never done this kind of work. And so we put together, we went to Bowley and Susan and a whole company of people, and we filled up a Holiday Inn conference room, standing only, probably 120 people. And I'll never forget, and we think very highly of Susan Woolley, I'll be very clear. She spent about 6 hours trying to explain how it is and what the risks are if you go into the public market. And this set of rules then you must live by. I remember the last thing she said, because it got a big laugh, and she said, but if you have any more questions, this is pretty complex, give me a call. So a lot of people avoid this market because they're afraid of what the downstream consequences will be, which means a year or two or three later, not for any intentional reason, but for unintentional reasons that Larry just barely walked you through, they're going to end up miscalculating. They're going to have clerical errors. They're going to punch the wrong button on the computer. And what happens is it's real fines. It's real money. And so we're constantly trying to work on this process, and it's why we're always so – it's why I keep an eye on every single bill that is ever dropped on prevailing wage rates, because we know how complex it is, and we have to try to figure out to make it work. But often people, other contractors, will have a conversation, you better be ready and you better be specialized and you better have a level of technical talent in your back room if you want to enter this market. So that's a really important overriding policy issue, that why we encourage people to be really slow, very careful when they start thinking about prevailing wage rate laws, what it applies to or anything else. That to us was a real lesson. And a lot of those people, as soon as the private work came back, a lot of them did not take the chance. They never went into the public market. That shrinks the number of contractors. Ultimately, it's probably likely going to drive up the cost for public work. That's just a fact. So, Larry, anything?
Well, I think as a general contractor, a lot of people don't understand how much time and money we spend trying to keep our subcontractors out of trouble. Because if we get a subcontractor that gets in trouble, it ultimately ends up being, as a general, it ends up being you that's responsible. Through my career, I've probably had 5 different cases where I've had a subcontractor get in trouble to where they weren't paying the right wage. and bully came after him, and that person just vanishes, and they're not responsible. And that's where the whole bond issue came in, is at least we got the bond from him, so at least then we had a chunk of money to pay something.
Right.
A lot of times I've had them in the $125,000 range of issues, and it's a big deal to the general. So as a general contract, you end up spending a lot of time and money looking at certifieds, making sure they're right. It's kind of twofold. One is to protect yourself, but secondly, it's a service to the subcontractors, because if we can catch it and get it corrected and it's not a bully issue, they're not in trouble. And so I'll tell you, on Sunwood Bridge, when I left up there, we were over 70 subcontractors at that time and a lot of small firms. And I don't think there's one company on that job, including the big union guys, that did not have issues with certified payrolls that we had to go back and get corrected. I mean, it's just that complex. It's so easy to miss the little things, especially when you start to get into ratios with apprentices. And, you know, you see what they're doing. They're out of ratios. So then you're going back to them saying, you can't have this guy. He doesn't have a journeyman here. So then you go back and pay the apprentice the journeyman scale. It's all those things that you try to keep them out of trouble of, so it doesn't land in the bully side of things and become a bigger issue. But anyway, so it's complex is all I can say.
Great. Yes.
I don't think you really explained certified payrolls. You kind of glossed over it.
No, I didn't explain that at all.
It's weekly.
I'll hit a little bit on it.
I just apologize. I have a meeting with a senator at 2 o'clock. I'm going to run out, and I'm sure Larry won't get us into any kind of trouble whatsoever. He'll tell you more than I know for sure. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, John. Okay, Larry, now you can tell us the truth.
I'm supposed to bite my tongue all day. In the back of the handout I gave you is actually the form for certified payroll. Most accounting software programs are set up to where you can get it to where you can mimic this form close enough to where you can actually print it right out of your accounting system. That's where a lot of the smaller people struggle that don't have systems that do that. Is their handwriting all these things every week, and they can get behind really fast, versus if you have the system, you do your payroll, you get done, you hit the button, it prints out, you sign them, send them in. But the certified is really explaining to the owner side of what you're paying the employee and how you're paying them. It comes down to where you're listing the individual employer or the employee, you're listing the craft, what they're doing. We'll have people on the open shop side. We could have somebody with three different crafts in a given day. If we have a laborer out there and all of a sudden we move into form work, most time we try to keep people busy, we'll bump that guy and pay him as a carpenter because now he's out of his labor craft, but we still have to pay him the rate for what he's performing. And so those things are all listed on here on your certified. You'll put them in every day. You'll list it out as what he's, you know, which group or which craft the zone pays, the fringe, and then on the fringe side, you list out the fringe, but then you gotta list out all the deductions. So if you have health and welfare, you list out the hourly on the health and welfare, what you're taking out. If you have a retirement program, you're turning that in, showing where your retirement program set up as. And so that's something that goes in at the beginning of the job. Once you establish that you do have a retirement program that the owner's looked at, then you're not turning that in every time other than just showing where the money is. This is a really critical thing. This here really tells a story as much as you can. Not saying that I haven't seen people turn in a certified payroll, and that's not actually what the employee may have got. So there's a process that the state goes through, and actually we do it on our own now, is going out and talking to the people in the field that are working in the field, and asking them, hey, are you getting your check weekly? We're watching for issues. Is somebody getting financial trouble? Because if an employee's not getting paid, ultimately we're going to end up paying the employee most of the time if the employer can't. And so we're looking at these things and checking to make sure that the employer is getting actually paid what's on the certified payroll. Because like I said, not everybody's an outstanding contractor like myself. I'm kidding. There are people out there that do take advantage of employees, and it's sad, but it's a reality. It always will be a reality. And that's partially what this is about, is making sure that's not happening as much as you can with the certification. They're due weekly. If you're on a prevailing wage job, You turn them in every week once you start. If you're doing no work, you still turn them in, show no work. And so there's a constant string through the project. Is there something else you want to hit on that, Kim? No? That's about as deep as I want to go anyway.
Thanks, Larry. Any other questions, Larry? This has been great, Larry. Thank you for walking us through this. It's great to see how it actually works.
Sure.
Thank you. Okay, we have a final panel from John Molis and Jack Dempsey. If you could, or Ron, you going to come up? Yeah. And I see that ODOT's in the room, but we've been saying nothing but nice things about ODOT, so we probably don't. Yeah, great.
Just one correction. I'm not Jack Dempsey, for the record. I'm Ron Robbins. I'm a contract administrator for the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, or more simply, the Carpenters Union.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Molis. I represent the Oregon State Building Trades Council. And I thought I'd just give a little bit of a history of an overview of the federal and the state law and how we view them. And then I think Ron's going to go a little deeper into some actual job site specific details. As Ms. Woolley said earlier, the federal Davis-Bacon or prevailing wage law went into effect during the Great Depression, and it was sponsored by Senator James Davis of Pennsylvania and Representative Robert Bacon of Long Island, New York. They were both Republicans. It was signed into law by President Hoover in 1931, and the intent of the law at the time was, as they were spending huge sums of money during the Great Depression to try and put people back to work, that those monies be paid to contractors and workers in the localities where the projects were getting built. As you heard earlier, the state of Oregon's prevailing wage survey has 14 different regions, and there's different wage rates around the state. You can imagine how many different wage rates there can be around the country, from the deep south to New York City to Massachusetts to Arizona to Oregon. And so obviously when they were building Timberline Lodge in Oregon during the Great Depression and some of the dams and other public works that were going on, the intent was to put Oregon contractors and Oregon workers to work. And that's the intent of the law, is to level the playing field so that contractors are awarded bids based on their level of expertise, the equipment and the management skills and the workers they bring to the job, not on how what the bottom level that anybody can pay their workforce is. Oregon's prevailing wage law, or Little Davis-Bacon law, was signed into law in 1959 by Governor Mark Hatfield, a Republican as well. And so we don't view this as a partisan issue. We view this as a community standards issue. And again, when the state of Oregon funds projects, or a school district in Beaverton or Burns or Bend funds a building, the intent is the same, I believe, to put local contractors and local workers to work. And we believe that there are studies that show that prevailing wage laws, both the federal law and laws in the states, they promote stability in the marketplace. They promote pension plans and health and welfare plans for workers, which I think are a good thing for workers and families and communities. And they also promote apprenticeship and training programs. I've got a Wall Street Journal article that I should be handing to the committee administrator right now. If you'd like, Chair Dembro, I can just go back and grab it real quick, and maybe she can distribute it.
Sure. Thank you.
Apologize for the delay. Mm-hmm. This is an article from the Wall Street Journal in 1994, and I got it out of the file just in the last couple of months for a couple of different reasons. And it's remarkable, even though the article is 21 years old, how many of the themes that are in the article are still the same today. Contractors are complaining about a looming workforce shortage, and this is the story is centered on a plumbing contractor in Arizona. Arizona is a state that doesn't have a prevailing wage law, and you'll read when you get a minute the quotes from the contractors about how hard it is to keep a good, well-trained workforce, about how members or how workers will, you know, jump ship and leave a contractor and, you know, for 50 cents an hour or a dollar an hour and run down the street, how the quality of the workforce has really suffered. And it just becomes a race to the bottom when you don't have any standards built into the construction workforce. And we take great pride in the millions and millions of dollars that we invest in our apprenticeship and training programs every year. I can look anybody in the eye and tell them that if you're thinking of building something in Oregon, we can send you the best trained, the most safe, the most quality-oriented workforce in the United States. And we do that in cooperation with our signatory contractors. We put a lot of time and effort into it, and we take a lot of great pride into it. And absent that standard, I think that's a lot tougher for us to do, which is provide the state of Oregon a very well-trained workforce without a nickel of public money. All those programs come from our industry collective bargaining agreements. So with that overview, I will stop. I would maybe ask, have one request, Chair Dembro. If there's time, if you could maybe get Ms. Woolley up here or somebody to talk a little bit about the debarment process in Oregon. I've served a couple of terms on the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, and I think you have to have a pretty egregious violation or more than one to get debarred. So in fairness, I think it'd be an interesting topic. But with that, I'll close. If there's any questions, I'd do my best to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Thanks. Ron.
Okay. A very broad topic. As a carpenter's representative, I represent crafts ranging from carpenters, drywall, pile drivers, millwrights, even divers in the state of Oregon. And prevailing wage is a wage stabilization effort, really. We don't prevail the entire state. We do, I guess, with divers. There's very few of them, and that's a very confined specific craft. But certainly carpenters and drywallers and pile drivers and millwrights range the entire state. So there are areas where we prevail, and there's areas that we do not. In areas, one of the issues that comes up is about that wage and about the zone pay that's associated with that. With carpenters, there's actually 24 reference cities that they can be dispatched from. Those are all negotiated with all of the crafts that I mentioned there, and so, you know, those rates again are negotiated with the AGC and our other major groups. In areas of the state, a good example, I guess, is Deschutes County. That's in Region 10. Our rates in that area are $5 or $6 below our union contract rate, and the benefit package is reduced to about $4 or $5. There is an impact at times in those rural areas of trying to get qualified manpower out to, you know, remote locations, bridge and highway, or pile driving is certainly an example of that. Bridges do not always occur in major cities. They're certainly built in extremely remote locations. And so we struggle at times with those rates where they're reduced, but we understand that the process is a fair one, and it's based on the wages for that area of the state, and it reflects the living standards and benefit packages in those areas. I have kind of an interesting history with the Carpenters Union. I've been a representative since 2004. My first assignment was in Idaho, a state that does not have Little Davis-Bacon. There, the only projects that were prevailed were federal highway projects. And what I saw on many, many public projects was contractors who were not licensed or bonded, or many of the employees were 1099. There was no reporting. There was no process for reporting what those wages were, and so there were no controls on it. I can think of one extreme situation that while I was there where we had identified a contractor that was coming in at night, and it was an all-Latino workforce doing the drywall on that project, and a few of the things jumped out at us about that, but we were there just to collect information. But at the end of the job, those workers didn't get paid, and they came to us to seek justice or see if we could get them paid. It's an example of when, if you don't have some wage stabilization, I think in part that's what prevailing wage does, you create a system that is truly race to the bottom and where only the low bid wins, and it's low bid at any cost, unfortunately. I have met several times here in Oregon. We don't do a whole lot of residential wood framing, although you see thousands of projects around the state right now that are large residential projects. I met recently with one of the three largest wood framing contractors. He's not a union contractor, but we've done some projects together. And what he told me was that, through this downturn, when it was low bid only, kind of a survival island in the wood framing industry, they were forced to cut their margins to such a point that frankly, he felt that they had destroyed their own market and that there was no money to be made there. He bid on a routine basis prevailing wage jobs because he said it was a way to reward his employees, who he cared about very much, with a living wage, a standard of living and benefits that would support a family. And so I think it draws, a contrast that without sufficient protections, and I think that's what prevailing wage does, that's what you're left with is that race to the bottom. One of the things that was covered by the last speaker was there seems to be a lot of confusion about the rates and that. I, as contract administrator for the carpenters, I get the dubious duty of writing what we call Schedule A's. It's the wage and benefit information breakdown for each of our contractors. And we provide those for prevailing wage areas like Region 10, where we don't prevail, for carpenters, and give guidance to our signatory contractors. But I think Boley does a very good job of that, too. Matter of fact, each contractor, when they bid prevailing wage, receive what they call a wage determination form. And that spells out the specific wage and benefit package for the craft for the project. And so good guidance there. But they've done a very good job, too, of following up with the contractor and being a resource, in my opinion. Up until very recently, we participated in a prevailing wage law enforcement fund with the AGC and the union side of that, and that was targeted at just prevailing wage education in the industry. And so going out to job sites, talking to contractors, seeing if there was confusion. That fund was discontinued recently because, frankly, Boley's doing a very good job in that area, and the funds, additional private funds, were not needed. And so that was discontinued. Again, I guess I'll reflect, like John, I know contractors that have have violated prevailing wage law. Most contractors are honest and don't intentionally do it. Unfortunately, there are a few in the industry that seek to profit by either misclassifying or paying the wrong wages to employees. Just a final note on apprentices. One thing to think about in prevailing wage, apprentices do have an exemption. Those wages are established by their apprenticeship standards, and so that's overseen by the Department of Apprenticeship through Boley. Generally speaking, carpenter craft apprentices start out at about 50% of carpenter journeyman wages. So, again, not to pick on Region 10, but that's about $14.50 an hour, a starting wage and a full benefit package. So, and I'll take any questions that you might have related to any of that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ron. Any questions for John or for Ron? Yes, yeah. Senator Roosevelt, please.
Just one question, and either of you can answer this, but I think you were here when John Rakowitz was testifying that now that the economy is starting to pick up again, a lot of contractors are no longer interested in bidding on public works projects because they don't want to deal with prevailing wage and its complexity. Are you finding that contractors are shifting to a private sector market and we're not going to have enough people willing to do the work on
We certainly projects? Don't see that.
Are you asking pre-Intel or post-Intel?
The economy is good, but it's not quite that good.
Yeah, Senator Denbrough, or Chair Denbrough, Senator Rosenbaum, I don't track the contracting end of it day to day. I think there are some smaller contractors that probably stay out of that marketplace just because they feel the burden is not worth it. But I know that there's a lot of contractors that bid it. I know there's a lot of public agencies that go out of their way to recruit small contractors, and you heard the early testimony about attracting MBWBE contractors, and that's ongoing. And as Chair Denbrough just said, I think it varies as well as what's going on in the private marketplace. So there's a number of different factors for the answer to that question.
Great.
Yes, Vice Chair.
What I think John might have been saying is when the economy turned, a lot of people were looking that weren't normally involved in public works projects to be involved with that and are deciding not to pursue that now that the economy is picking up. So they're just bowing back out. I think that's what he was saying.
Could be as well.
Okay, thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
And before I close this, I will ask Susan to come back up and just let us know what it takes to get somebody onto the bad guy list.
That's a very good question. It's actually not that easy to get on the list. There's only four ways. If a contractor intentionally fails to pay wages to the worker, if they intentionally falsify certified payroll reports, if they intentionally fail to post the rates on the project site. I keep focusing on that word or emphasizing the word intentionally because we have to prove that intent. So we can't just debar people. We actually give them a notice of intent, and we go to an administrative law judge, and we go to a hearing together. We present our case, the contractor presents their case, and we have to be able to prove that there was intent to violate the law. It's not just an accidental missing an hour here or there. The fourth way somebody could end up on that list is if a subcontractor fails to pay the wages and the prime pays on their behalf, that subcontractor could then be added to the list.
Thank you. Senator Rosenbaum?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Thatcher.
If there is ever a wage claim, does it always just go through BOLI, or do the agencies sometimes take action on their own?
It depends on the agency. I think ODOT may sometimes do some investigating on their own, but if it's an actual wage claim that they file with BOLI, we're going to be the one to take a look at it. But sometimes workers might go to that agency who's the owner of that project first. So I guess the agency could decide at that point if they wanted to do it or if they wanted to refer that worker back to us. So if another agency like ODOT were to do an investigation, they don't have that same debarment authority. So somebody would only end up on this list if BOLI were to do that investigation.
But then again, are they under the same sort of process rules as far as being able to resolve a conflict or a question that might be raised as to a wage determination or, you know, somebody making a claim? Or do they have the kind of their own rules of operation?
If the project is subject to the Davis-Bacon Act, they actually have that authority to enforce the Davis-Bacon Act.
Whatever fashion.
Right, in whatever method they may want to follow to enforce that. They don't have that same enforcement authority with the state laws, but they've entered into a contract with this contractor, so they can enforce their contract agreement with them. Does that answer the question? Yeah. Okay. Great.
And one last question, Susan. The there was mentioned before about Boley perhaps automating its, you know, its information, making that more easily. Is that being talked about at all in the agency?
We haven't. I have looked at the comparison tool that ODOT has, and it is pretty slick. It's really nice. You would have to do it for every single project, and that feels a little overwhelming. I'm not quite sure how we could do that for the hundreds of projects around the state. So it isn't anything that we've talked about, but I am aware of that program, and it is pretty great.
Okay, great. And there was mention that maybe it's used in Washington.
I don't know. I haven't heard of that. I thought we were the only ones that the person at ODOT was the only one who had come up with that. Yeah.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much.
Sure. You're welcome.
Yeah. Okay, so with that, I'm going to close our information hearing on prevailing wage. Thank you all who came to be part of that. And we have work sessions on two bills, and I'm going to start with House Bill 2544. And let me tell you where we are with this, colleagues. We have a Dash 5 amendment. Now, 2544 is the one related to interim bargaining in the public sector, midterm bargaining. We are going to have to send this bill to rules because we just got these amendments, and I think that they resolve most of the concerns, but I don't feel comfortable sending it to the floor until we're really sure about that. So we're gonna send it to rules, but I would like to adopt these Dash 5s. So if we could have a motion for that, and then I'll explain just what exactly they do.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated June 3rd, 2015.
Okay, Senator Thatcher has moved to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated June 3rd, 2015. So you will remember that in the base form of 2544, there was a route to do arbitration, right? That is, if a new provision were introduced by the employer and the employees objected to it. Then there would be some negotiations over that, which could last no more than 90 days, and then at the end of 90 days, the employer could implement. And with this change, with the change in the base bill, that would allow for mediation, mandatory mediation, and if that didn't work, there would be arbitration. What we have here in the Dash 5s is the arbitration piece is taken out, and it would be mandatory mediation, which addressed one of the concerns that we heard from opponents. Another issue that did come up was a concern that you negotiate a contract and then right away the employer introduces a new provision, and that caused a great deal of concern. You may remember we had testimony from the School Boards Association, which suggested that we set a period, and what was proposed was 60 days, where the employer could not change the contract, propose to change the contract, and then mandatory mediation would be, the only remedy then. And what we've developed in the Dash 5s is kind of uses that framework, and it says that for a contract, a short-term contract, one that's less than 2 years, that 60-day window would apply on the front end, that is, 60 days after both parties have ratified and also 60 days before the expiration of the contract, because presumably during that period you're going to be able to address that in negotiations which are going on for the new contract. But within that window, then you would have the mandatory, the employer could propose, and you would have mandatory mediation. If a contract is longer than that, if it's 2 years or more, then that window would be 180 days on each side, because you know you've got a longer contract period there. My hope was that this would solve the problem that we're trying to fix here. At least we will see if mandatory mediation makes a difference. And you know, my hope is that it would. It would probably resolve most of our issues. Now, I will say that just this afternoon, or earlier this afternoon, I did get a request from the Employment Relations Board to go at this one more time, because they're concerned. If you look at the amendment, and this has been in the bill, I think from the beginning. I'm not sure that the. After the employer has notified notified the union of the change, then the union would file a demand to bargain with the employer, but also with the Employment Relations Board, and they're concerned that they're going to have to be notified every time this happens, and start files and do record keeping, and really in most cases it'll be unnecessary. They really only need to be notified if mediation is needed. And so they would prefer that we, strike the Employment Relations Board from, the parties that need to be notified, just, if there's a concern. Since this will have to go to the Rules Committee anyway, I think it makes sense for us to go ahead and adopt the Dash 5s. Just put on record what we're trying to do here, and then make that further fix. And I would be happy to answer any questions or hear your thoughts about this.
So, Mr. Chair, yes. To clarify, we're going to adopt the Dash 5s, move it to Rules, and they might be adopting another Dash potentially in the future to resolve any other issues with ERB.
This issue with ERB, correct. But I think it's important for us to send it to Rules, with the understanding of the direction that we're headed. Okay, is there any further discussion of the Dash 5s? Okay, is there any objection to our adopting the Dash 5s? Seeing none, they are adopted.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2544. As amended to the floor, with the due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 2544 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Rules. Any discussion?
I will make one comment in that I appreciate moving to mediation. Making people meet and talk is always a good thing. Rather than the binding arbitration, because I think there were some big concerns over that. But knowing that there will still need to be some changes made, probably, maybe, likely, in the committee, just rather than it sailing through here with 5-0, I don't know, I'm going to just kind of put a little tick in there to say, hey, look at this a little closer. So. Okay.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll be a no as well. I think this bill could be gently put to sleep here in this committee.
Thank you for your kind thoughts, Senator.
It happened to one of my bills in another committee. It gently, gently.
Well, gentle is better than
taking it out back and shooting.
Otherwise, yes, right?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
With a nail gun.
Right.
With a nail gun.
Carrie, would you call the roll then, please?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Dembrough?
Aye. Okay, the motion carries. This bill will go to rules as amended. Okay, I'll close our work session on House Bill 2544. And Carrie, let's stand at ease for a moment, please. Okay, friends, it is now 3:50, and we are back in session. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3025. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules to waive the one-hour notice requirements for amendments.
Okay, Senator Thatcher has moved to suspend the rules to waive the one-hour notice requirement for amendments. And colleagues, that's because the amendments just came in about a half hour ago. But in all other respects, we are ready to move forward. Is there any objection to our suspending the rules? Seeing none, the rules are suspended, and we will move forward.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash A-29 amendments dated June 3rd, 2015.
Senator Thatcher has moved to adopt the Dash A-29 amendments dated June 3rd, 2015. Let me let you know what is in the A-29s. Because I just realized we haven't talked about these at all. So this is, of course, the Ban the Box bill. And you'll remember that it came over from the House with a number of changes from the base bill. And we have made further changes to it to deal with concerns and to deal with potential objections. And just to give you a quick overview of what those are, we wanted to make it clear and therefore put in the language that's in Section 1, Sub 3, that subject to subsections 1 and 2, those are the ones that say that the issue of criminal conviction cannot come up prior to the interview. Subject to those subsections, nothing in this section prevents an employer from considering an applicant's conviction history when making a hiring decision. Okay, just want to make that clear that this says that the question can't be put on a form, the question can't be asked, the check can't be done before the individual has had a chance to present their case face-to-face. But if the employer determines that this is not going to work, there is no obligation for that person to hire the applicant. And we clarified in sub 4 a little more of the situation of who should be exempted from this. And we exempted anyone, any situation in which federal, state, or local law, including corresponding rules and regulations, requires the consideration of an applicant's criminal history. That is, these are individuals who are not going to be able to work. And so there seemed no sense in having them go through the effort for both sides of applying. So they are exempted from this. And I think when we had our public hearing, we talked about that. It was there in concept, but we hadn't yet presented. And we did make a further change by including corresponding rules and regulations. That was important to the bankers, as an example, whose employees are under FDIC or SEC kinds of regulations. So, The big change that we made was to eliminate the private right of action from this bill. And we did that, and then we had to make sure that we still had explicit reference to the enforcement authority that Boley would have with respect to this issue. And in an earlier draft, it was left out, and then it was put in, but we didn't get the reference quite right, the statutory reference. Everyone assures me that this is the right reference and that this then does what we wanted it to do. And so I really want to thank the majority and minority caucuses here for working together to help us get to this point. So that is, in a nutshell, what the A29s do, and be happy to entertain any further discussion. Okay, seeing none, is there any objection to our adopting these amendments? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3025A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 3025A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair.
I just want to say I really appreciate the you taking, consistently taking suggestions from the other side and attempting to find some places of agreement. And I think this is one of those places, though I really don't I appreciate it, but I can't get there on the policy right now.
Thank you for that. Yes, Senator Quinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be a no vote on the bill itself. I just think the bill is way too broad. I think it puts employers and their employees, quite frankly, in jeopardy. We're going to see ramifications from this of business owners and HR people not knowing conviction histories of the people they're interviewing. I think that creates problems. But just generally, I think business owners have a right to know who they're hiring, and I think to hide that information on application, I don't think is the right way to go. If this was much narrower for nonviolent misdemeanors, I could see that. But as far as I can tell, this includes any crime committed, and I couldn't support that really under any circumstances.
Thank you. Further discussion? Senator Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I just would say I think this bill is extremely narrow in scope compared to the original bill I was just looking back on as introduced that would have limited the use of criminal background checks. The bill in no way now takes away any employer's ability to do criminal background checks, and the language of the amendment makes it clear that they can consider a conviction history when making a hiring decision. So really the only thing it prohibits is having a question on the initial application that says, have you been convicted of a crime? And I think, people who have served their time and are trying to be doing the right thing and getting jobs have huge obstacles against them. I know just from talking to Senator Shields, who's done a lot of work with trying to find employment for ex-offenders, that it is very hard to get people back to work in the jobs that they would be eligible to even apply for. So I think, the bill is a very, very limited step in trying to level the playing field that isn't by any means going to tie in employers' hands in the tools that they should have. So I just see it differently, and will be a yes vote.
And then I'll just say before we vote that, yes, in many ways this is a limited bill, but I also think it's an important bill. And I think it really sends a strong signal, together with the task force that, I'm expecting that we're going to be creating on the subject of eliminating barriers to reentry with respect to employment and housing. I think that it's sending a strong message that the legislature wants to remove barriers and not give up hope on people who have served their time. When we discussed this in our caucus, one of our members told us of his experience as a business owner You know, we're, you know, he told us that during the time that the economy was in a condition which they had lots of applicants for jobs, any application that showed a conviction, a criminal history, would go straight into the wastebasket. And then when the job market tightened up and they had a hard time finding candidates, they loosened that. They were forced to, and they took some people on. And he said, you know what? They were some of our very best employees. And if we had not taken a chance with them, if we had just thrown their application into the garbage can, we would have lost some of our best employees. And I was very moved by that. I was already inclined to support this, but you know, his testimony or his statement there at the meeting, you know, really confirmed that I think we're on the right track in approving this, in giving people a chance, you know, really giving some substance to the notion of giving people a second chance. I think there are a lot of safeguards in this bill that will protect employers, and you know, therefore I'm going to vote yes on this. So, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser.
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair
Debra? Aye. Okay, the motion carries. Motion passes, and was there a sponsor on this?
No.
All right, then I'll carry the bill.
Dang, I was hoping I could. I'm just kidding.
Okay, so with that, I'll close our work session on House Bill 3025A. Colleagues, there's nothing left for us other than our party, which stay tuned, you will hear about. And please enjoy the rest of the day, the rest of the week. We are adjourned. And thanks, everyone. Sure.